Leviticus. We're not going to cover Leviticus, you know, in totality at all. I'm not going to get close to that. But these chapters that I asked you to read or skim through last time, chapters 8 through 16, we are going to focus on some things found in these chapters. And I think once we do that, we'll really see how profitable they are, and even how Leviticus is a lot more tangible. It doesn't seem as kind of distant to us in our understanding of what are we supposed to do with this. Maybe we'll fix that problem or help to solve that problem. Leviticus is difficult for us. Some of the things talked about are just such a foreign concept to us. Almost nothing like what we're required to do today. And so because of that, you know, for the most part, it just strikes us as extremely odd. And so we're going to discuss that this morning. Think about the Israelites when they came out of Egyptian slavery. They've come out of bondage. God has released them from bondage. And if we're trying to think about how they would think, what their mindset would be, I think that'll help us as we look through these parts of Leviticus. If you were to talk to the Israelites about deity, you know, divine beings, gods, they'd probably think or say, oh yeah, there's a lot of gods, right? You've got Ra and Isis, those Egyptian gods. Some of the nations around us serve Anu or Enki. All right, we've got nations over here. Chemosh, that's who they worship. Molech, you've got Yahweh. You've got Asherah. You've got Baal, especially in different areas. Baal is worshipped. That's how they would think of deity. Now, what's the obvious problem here in this, you know, this mindset as they're coming out of Egyptian slavery, traveling with Moses? What's the problem that hopefully stands out to you when you look at this picture? Well, that's true, and I think the second part is it. Anybody else want to say more specifically what's the problem here? It's not a trick question. Everybody's looking at me like I know this is a trick question. It's not. Well, here's the problem. Yahweh, well, that's the Hebrew word for the Lord. That's God's name. And yet he's just listed among the other gods, right? It's just, oh yeah, divine beings, deity. You've got this one and this one and this one and Yahweh and this one and this one and this one. Well, that's a problem. And I think sometimes we forget when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they were worshiping Egyptian gods. When they were in Egypt, and when they came out of Egypt, they were worshiping false gods. And so one of the things that the Lord had to do was to show them that he is so different from the rest. That he is so set apart from the rest. Not only that he's the only one that's real, not only that he's the only one that has any real power, but even just in his personality, just in his characteristics. Because the pagans, they had stories about all their gods. And so there were personalities for their gods and characteristics of their gods. And when you examine how the pagans thought of their gods, those pagan gods were so human. So human. They had human characteristics. You know, they were hateful. Sometimes they didn't care about anything. They just did whatever they wanted. Who cares? Some of them, you know, wanted to just destroy all men because men are annoying. And I just want to destroy them. Some of the pagan gods, you know, they're not real. But according to the stories and the beliefs, some of the pagan gods engaged in sexual acts. They were greedy. You know, they love to take revenge. I mean, just all this stuff that is just so human, which makes sense because they were made up by humans. And so some of the commands, you know, if you're going to follow one of the pagan gods, some of the commands would be stuff like child sacrifice. You know, this pagan god loves child sacrifice. And so you can see how Yahweh had to distinguish himself in the minds of the Israelites. I am nothing like these other gods. I am set apart from these other gods in many, many ways. And so that brings us to the idea of holiness. And that really is just the predominant theme throughout Leviticus. Holiness. Constantly you have God saying something like, I am holy, therefore you should be holy. And that's just throughout the book. The idea of the Lord's holiness, and you Israelites, you need to be holy because I am holy. And so when we think about what the word holy means, so often we just instantly go to morality. That's the first place our minds go. Holiness, it has to do with morality. And yet, ultimately, yeah, I mean, that's where God takes it, and that's the greatest sense of it. But it's not always, especially in the Old Testament laws, it's not always just about morality. The word holy means set apart. And so, of course, God is holy. Set apart, you know, in so many ways. Set apart from the other gods, from man, from the heavens and the earth. He is set apart. And so when he calls on something to be holy, or when he deems something holy, he's calling upon it to be set apart for his purposes. And not just set apart like geographically, like it's moved over, but in its nature, it is set apart for the Lord's service, for the Lord's purpose. And so that makes it not common. You know, if something has been set apart, well, then it's unlike everything else, the rest. Everything else that's common. This is not common, it's set apart. And so God is set apart from those common pagan gods. And God is set apart from common man. And so the point is, he has set Israel apart. They are not to be like the common people of the world. They are set apart for his purposes. And so it's important for us to understand that. But like I said, when we hear holy, we always think of morally holy. Well, Leviticus, though, talks about things not in regard to moral holiness, not in regard to morality, but in regard to ritual holiness. And in regard to ritual cleanliness. And that's what these chapters, at least several of these chapters in Leviticus, are talking about. They're talking about these methods God put in place for the Israelites to follow so they could be ritually clean and not be ritually unclean. And then methods so that they can be not just ritually clean, but ritually holy. And so let's kind of examine that. Here's a definition. I didn't make this up, but I think it's a really good definition of what it means when we're talking about ritual holiness, ritual cleanliness. It is an imaginary way of perceiving and classifying people, places, and things loosely based on the idea of hygienic cleanliness. All right, so I'll give you a second to kind of look over that definition. You know, it's imaginary. It's something that God made up, and now the Israelites are going to imagine too. And we're not talking about morality here, just these ritual states. It's an imaginary way of perceiving people, or of perceiving places, or of perceiving objects, things, and then putting them in a category, in a class. Holy, common. Clean, unclean. And it's loosely based on the idea of hygienic cleanliness. Hygienic cleanliness is the imagery that they use. And so God gave them these rules. And according to these rules, okay, in this situation, that person, I'm supposed to consider them unclean. And this person over here, I'm supposed to consider them clean. And this object over here, because of what this object is, or because of what's happened to this object, I consider that clean or unclean, depending on what rules God has given us. And so God specifies the rules here, you know, His commands. You'll think of this as holy. You'll think of this as clean. You'll think of this as unclean. And it's an imaginary way of perceiving things. I don't mean imaginary like it's goofy or something. I mean, it's serious. But when they're looking on somebody and considering them unclean, there's not actually something on the person. You know, there's nothing to see. You know, if somebody's unclean, you know, it's not like, well, obviously there's the uncleanness all over them. You know, it's you're just considering it that. You know, it's a mindset about it. You're perceiving it that way. So let's get into some specifics of this. It used wording like clean, washing, purify, defilement. It used those kind of terms. And you see that a lot throughout Leviticus. That kind of terminology is used. But it's not about actual health or hygiene. And I think we make this mistake a lot. I've heard this a lot. The people say, well, some of Israel's laws are because God wants to keep them from contracting viruses. So there's a lot of washing they have to do. Or that there's disease. He doesn't want to spread through the camp, you know, because certain things are not hygienic. And so he wants to make sure that they're clean and that germs are taken care of. Or that, well, some of the foods they eat, you know, he didn't let them eat some of these foods because that food is more likely to cause food poisoning if it's not cooked right or something. So he wants to protect them from food poisoning or sickness. That's not it. It's not about literal physical health and hygiene. That's not what God's concerned with. Leviticus never says that at all. But that is the imagery. You know, just like if you ate something that could make you sick, if you ate something, you know, against this law that God gave, it could make you ritually unclean. And just like engaging in this activity could make you physically, literally dirty or physically, literally contract some sort of sickness. Well, that's the imagery here, that according to God's law, you are ritually unclean. And so the terminology is there, but God's point is not about keeping them physically healthy or hygienic. He's just using that terminology to convey this kind of ritual cleanliness and holiness. And so you hear a lot of people saying the opposite of what I just said. So if you have heard something different or disagree, we don't have time to discuss that. I think there's some really good reasons why I make that statement, that it's not about actual health or hygiene. So if you want to talk afterward, I'd be happy to do that, because I think that is a pretty common misunderstanding we have, thinking that they're out in the wilderness and God's trying to keep them from all getting sick. And so we can talk about that after class if you want to. This is important too. Being ritually unclean did not mean you were guilty of sin, necessarily. Don't equate those two. If someone's unclean, it doesn't mean that they've sinned in some way. I mean, yeah, somebody that sinned was unclean in that metaphorical sense. But just because you're ritually unclean doesn't mean you've sinned. Some of the times when you become ritually unclean, it's stuff you can't even help. You know, something that happens to all people at some point. Something that's unavoidable. And so God's not saying those of you that are clean are the righteous ones, and those of you that are unclean, ritually unclean, you've done something wrong. That's not it. But he is giving them a way to classify and perceive this person's unclean, this person's clean. Right now I'm unclean, and I need to do what I need to do to become clean. But don't think of it as right and wrong, good and bad. And we'll talk about the specific things that make you unclean, and I think that'll make this more clear. And then also, impurity was spread most of the time by physical contact. So that if I am ritually unclean, if I go over here and pat Wayne on the shoulder, he's ritually unclean. Even if he didn't know that I was ritually unclean, Even if I didn't know I was ritually unclean. If I was unclean and I didn't know it, and I shook hands with 10 people, and then I find out that I am ritually unclean, I've done something, you know, that made me unclean, all 10 of those people I shook hands with are also unclean. That's usually how it spread. Or that I sat somewhere and got up and somebody else sat there. Well, that could be something that could spread the uncleanness. And so it's physical contact. That's predominantly what spreads this. Now, let's go over, okay, specific sources. How do you become impure, ritually impure, ritually unclean? There's four primary categories, I think. And once again, I didn't make up these categories, but I think that I heard these. I think these are good to kind of summarize a lot of this. Dead bodies. Whether it's a human or an animal, dead bodies would make you ritually unclean. And so you see, well, if somebody dies in your house, you haven't sinned, right? But you do have to touch the body and move the body, you know, and take care of the body. And so that would make you ritually unclean. So you'd have to then go through the process God established for fixing that. Or if you encounter an animal carcass. Let's say an animal wanders into the camp and just dies in front of your tent. Well, you've got to move it. All right, so that's going to make you ritually unclean, but, you know, that's okay. You've just got to go through the procedures for that. And so dead bodies are a major source of uncleanness. Leprosy is something else. And we hear leprosy, you know, most of my life, leprosy, well, that is the disease where your flesh just starts deteriorating and it kills you and it's just this horrific, horrible, permanent thing. That's really not what the Bible's talking about most of the time, you know, in these Levitical laws. Yeah, that would be included in what it means when it says leprosy. But leprosy was a broad term. It just talked about different skin conditions. And when you read through these laws, most of the time these skin conditions clear up and heal. So, you know, it's not what we necessarily think of when we think of, oh, leprosy. I've seen, you know, pictures of that horrific, fatal, terrible thing. That's usually not what's being referred to here. Any sort of skin condition, psoriasis, infection that spreads on the skin, you know, certain types of irritation, skin irritations, eczema, stuff like that, would be fall into the category of leprosy. And so when you had those, that made you unclean. Now, you didn't sin or something, but that made you unclean. And so you had to go through the process of dealing with that. Sexual functions. Now, I don't even mean immoral sexual functions. Just the normal and God-approved sexual functions. If you engage in sexual intercourse with your spouse, you're unclean for the rest of the day. And so you have to make sure that you abide by the rules there that God set up. There's nothing wrong with that. There's everything right with that, right? God created sexuality, created sex. And so having that with your spouse is good, but it would fall under unclean. Or any sort of bodily discharges, you know, and you can read through Leviticus, there are some specifics given there. All right, not always the most pleasant things to read through, but those kind of abnormal bodily discharges, that would make you unclean, so you had a ritual to go through to become clean again. And childbirth is also, you know, a major one. A woman who gave birth was unclean for a certain period of time. Of course, not that she sinned or anything. Every woman that gave birth was considered unclean for a certain period of time. So those kinds of things. And then meats, right? Certain animals that were considered clean, you could eat from and still be clean. Certain animals that were unclean, God said, don't eat from those. So there is a command there not to eat from those. And they are considered unclean. And so God gives specifics. This one's clean, this one's not. This type of animal's clean, this type of animal's not. And so they had to adjust and figure out what they're going to do in regard to eating based on those on those laws. And that, the meats, the clean and unclean animals, next Sunday I'll be out of town, and Paul Gavin's going to cover for me and teach that class. And he's going to teach on the clean and unclean animals and draw lessons from that. So we'll talk about that. Well, we won't. You all talk about that next Sunday. All right, so let me, you know, I know we've gone through a lot, and for a lot of us, this is just something that is just completely new, completely foreign. So I know this can be difficult. I'm watching that clock, and I'm worried about getting through everything. But here's one of the major things that uncleanness meant. If you were unclean, it meant seclusion either in your home or for the major types of uncleanness, you are separated from the camp. And so for a period of time, you are not living in your tent among Israel's camp. You are living outside of the camp. You've been secluded or separated outside the camp. And so think about, especially based on our class last week, think about what that would mean. If you are separated outside the camp, what's the major significant point about that? What's something that just, for an Israelite, in their society, how they do things, what would make that so significant, to be outside the camp? Loss of fellowship with who? People within the camp and... I heard somebody say it. God, right? Yeah. Because remember, we talked about last week, God is dwelling in their midst. In fact, He's dwelling right in the middle of the camp. Right? That's where the tabernacle is. That's where God is dwelling. He's in the middle of the camp, and He specified this tribe dwells here, this tribe dwells here, this tribe dwells here. And so the camp is set up with Him there in the midst of them. And so if you are outside of the camp, you are as far away from God as you can be. You are outside of that dwelling of God, which means you can't participate in the sacrifices. You can't come into the courtyard of the tabernacle and engage with the priests in regards to offerings and that. You can't do that. You're separated for that time and can't engage in that way. And in order to come back, there are certain requirements. Whether it's a time period you have to wait, followed by an offering, followed by some sort of consecration act, whether it involves oil or blood or whatever, there's a procedure to go through so that you can be considered clean again. And because I'm clean again, I can come back into the camp, or I can go to the tabernacle and I can offer those gifts again and have that fellowship then with Israel, but especially with my God. And so that's an important point about all this. All right, so let me now get into this. What exactly was God trying to teach Israel here, right? I mean, He gave them these rules, and we look at them, and a lot of times we think, what a weird thing to have them do. You know, that somebody in this situation leaves, you know, or somebody that this happens to them, they are deemed unclean, especially for some of the stuff we looked at, like contact with a dead body or, you know, sexual intercourse or childbirth, you know, skin conditions. Like, that seems very odd that God would have them engage in this, especially if it's not, like, a skin condition is not about morality, right? If it was moral things, we'd understand. But keep in mind, Israel is just so ignorant of God. I think we just forget that sometimes. Throughout their history, the reason why they make so many stupid mistakes is they just don't get it. They don't understand how holy God is. They don't understand how holy they're supposed to be. They don't understand how to reflect God's holiness. And so God gives them these building blocks in their laws to kind of serve as training wheels to get them to understand true holiness. And so because of that, this ritual holiness, these rules, are trying to point them toward moral holiness, God's holiness. And if we imagine ourselves in those situations, I think we can understand how that happens, how the care and concern that they had to show would help then with moral issues. So they were required to care about and distinguish between clean and unclean and holy. So you can imagine just constantly with the priests helping, I mean, the priests were supposed to teach the people, they were supposed to distinguish this God considers clean and this he doesn't. This God said was holy, so I need to treat it this way because it's been set apart for God's purposes. Doing that with things that don't have to do with morality help then, because you've had that kind of practice, help then distinguishing this is morally wrong and this isn't. And the way they're able to do that better is because they're used to doing that in every aspect of their lives. Right? In regard to the material their tents are made out of, in regard to their skin, in regard to their diet, in regard to their relationship with their spouse. I mean, all of those things, they've had practice distinguishing clean and unclean and caring about that. And so because of that, that helps them then to do that when it comes to moral things. This is also huge, right? That they're being taught your actions affect others. Because if I'm unclean and I don't care and walk around, well, it's going to affect everyone else, right? This only really works, this whole system only really works if everyone does it. Because if you've got 20 or 30 Israelites that don't follow these rules, the rest of the camp's affected because they're walking around making other people unclean, touching them, or touching things that they eat, or sitting in places where they sit, and it just affects the whole camp. And so what this does is create a unified culture, as long as they follow it, which they often didn't, but it creates a unified culture where we are focused on the group and keeping the group clean. And if someone's unclean, we take care of that so the rest of the group is not affected. That really serves to unify them in so many ways and keep them from having a self-centered mindset. Their actions affect others. It also trained them to look to priests for intercession. Because so often their unclean conditions, the priests had to teach them about that, help them with that. They had to go to the priest for these various things. And so it ingrained in their minds the idea that priests are necessary for me, especially in my fellowship with God. And this is something that is stressed. The importance of returning to God's presence. Being outside the camp is bad. You have to do what you need to do to get back inside the camp. You know, being outside the camp is not the ideal, right? Because you can't participate in the fellowship and the sacrifices there at the tabernacle. You have to return to God's presence. And so that was ingrained in their minds. We must do what we need to do so that we're in the normal state of being in the camp. And then this, entering God's presence requires respect, atonement, and submission to his commands. They were taught that. They were taught not to take for granted being in God's presence. Yeah, you can just walk into, you know, another God's temple, maybe. But your God is still holy. You don't just walk in. You know, there are certain things you have to do. And so it taught them to respect the idea of being in God's presence. And it taught them, you can't just do it. There has to be atonement made. That's why there's so much blood in the Levitical system. So much bloodshed of animals. You have to have your state atoned for before you can walk into God's presence. And you have to follow whatever God specified for how you return. It's not just, well, I did these things and I feel like that's great. No, God has specified this is what you do so that you can return to my sanctuary, to my tabernacle and into my camp. And then ultimately, this is the lesson of all of Leviticus, really. All the Bible, really. But God is holy, which is just obvious. If you're in the Levitical system and you're following these specifics, okay, God is set apart, you know, because of all these things we're having to do, and His holiness must be reflected in us. They had to symbolize God's holiness in how they dealt with these certain issues. And they had to reflect that, not just to each other, but to the other nations, right? Because God called upon them to be a kingdom of priests. And so they had to make sure that the other nations saw in them distinctness and set apartness, so that it taught the other nations our God is distinct and our God is set apart. So I know that's a lot, but let's talk about, okay, well, when we look at that today, you know, Christians today in our modern times, what does that instill in us? Well, the same exact things. I think we have a major problem with really understanding holiness, or at least acting like we understand it. And I think one of the reasons that we struggle is because we don't really study this system. If we study this system and what they had to go through and the lessons that were instilled in them, I do think that will help us in regard to how we think of holiness, how we think of God. The idea of caring and distinguishing between unclean, clean, and holy, well, we don't have to do that with those ritual clean and unclean things, but we absolutely have to do that when it comes to morality. And so looking at what they had to do will help us appreciate. If God cared so much about that, the ritual clean and unclean holiness, well, then He absolutely cares about the moral holiness and making those distinctions between what is right and what is wrong. My actions affecting others, I mean, that's huge. You know, it's not that when I sin, that if I go and pat somebody on the shoulder, well, they're a sinner now because of that. No, but my sin does influence other people. It is a major influence. And my sin, if it's ignored, brings shame upon everyone that just ignores it. I mean, it's the whole idea of a little leaven leavens the whole lump, right? I mean, that is something that the Corinthian church suffered from. They probably could have used a strong lesson in Leviticus and how your uncleanness needs to be dealt with and you cannot let it affect others. That probably would have taught them a lot, you know, when it came to the man who had his father's wife, that everyone just kind of shrugged their shoulders at that and just allowed that without thinking, no, if there's anything God taught us in the old law, it's that we cannot ignore our uncleanness because it affects all of us. It affects the group. The need for priestly intercession, I mean, right, that's what Jesus is for us, right, our high priest. And so understanding that the Israelites were trained to look to the priests for teaching them what they need to do, same thing with us. And we also serve as priests to the world, bringing them to God, being the mediator between man and God and bringing them to God, teaching them about the Lord. The importance of returning to God's presence, right? I mean, I'll be honest. There's times where I've been in sin, and I have not been quick to repent of that, not been quick to get back into God's presence. Sometimes it kind of feels nice, if we're honest, to just kind of not think about spiritual things for a few days, kind of take a spiritual break, and just kind of enjoy that. That is not something the Israelites would have been trained to do at all. There is a need to return to God's presence and have that fellowship with God. But, just like with them, entering into God's presence requires respect, atonement, and submission to His commands. You know, we don't gather together as God's temple, and one of us is just an unrepentant sinner, and who cares? Right? I mean, that's no. There is respect for entering into God's temple. And there is atonement that has been made by Jesus. That's why we can be God's temple. And we can't just then transgress that atonement and think we can still just be in God's presence. and not follow all of his commands because it's fine. You know what I mean? No, that's just, you know, something that God has always cared about. And then ultimately, God is holy. His holiness must be reflected in us. I mean, that has to be our primary concern. The reason why we do the things we do is because our God is so set apart, and we have been set apart from the world, and the world must see that we are holy and set apart in that moral sense. Whereas with Israel, it was in a moral sense, but also even just in a ritual sense. So I know that's a lot. That's probably just like way too much. But I set myself up to where I'm out of town next week. So I was like, I have to finish because I'm not going to be here. So we have at least a couple minutes. There's probably a lot of questions, and I probably don't have all the answers because I have a lot of questions about this. But yeah. Yeah.
His skin wasn't getting any better. And he wasn't coming back to the group. We read about the woman that had the hemorrhage.
Yeah.
That was healed. She wasn't coming back until she got healed. But in the new law, there isn't that situation. There isn't a situation where we won't come back. So it strikes me as, you know, one of the but the way the new law
is greater,
greater than the old law.
Yeah. Well, I think what that does, because you're right, if somebody has a permanent case of some disease, they're outside the camp. They're not returning. Or like the lady that just had a hemorrhage of blood continually, I think what that would be analogous to is, okay, somebody today that is morally unclean, and there's a way to fix that, but they won't, right? I mean, somebody that just is rebellious to the Lord and will not do what God says they need to do to be cleansed from that, they're forever outside of God's presence, right? They can't come back until that's dealt with. And so I think what you're saying is correct. That analogy there is strong, is good, yeah. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it would be separated from that, for lack of a better way to describe it, that focused, concentrated God's presence that's in the tabernacle. Because God use that to teach his people, like, I'll be right here, and you can't come closer. Well, we know that God is omnipresent, so he's still everywhere, but that does teach us something about God's presence. And so, yeah, I mean, even if you're outside the camp, it's not that you're in a world without God or something. You know, he's there, but there isn't that distinct presence and that distinct relationship that he created, I think, ultimately, to help us now understand the greatest presence of God in heaven, entering into that. So yeah, it's talked about in spatial terms. I think to help them understand that concept. And so I think the same thing's true with us. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying. So all right, well, next Sunday, Paul's going to cover clean and unclean animals. And so that's specifically Leviticus 11. So read Leviticus 11, and then Paul will lead everyone through that next Sunday. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.